The sun had been up for an hour by the time Remo started driving west again on Highway 62. This time, Remo picked up Highway 11 south from Edwardsville, down through Elizabeth, and came in toward Ideal Maternity from the reverse of his original approach. He pushed the Chrysler well beyond the posted limit, watching out for cops along the way, aware that precious time was slipping through his hands. By now, they definitely would have noticed the two guards and one young woman missing. Even if they didn't find the bodies, it was bound to cause a flap with staffers at the home. It was impossible for him to guess how they would react, but Remo had a nasty feeling in his gut. If Dr. Radcliffe and his flunkies started cutting losses, the young women might be first to go. He had enjoyed the second call to Smith at Falcroft. Smith listened carefully while Remo ran the problem down, and though he cleared his throat from time to time as if about to speak, he managed not to interrupt. When Remo finished, Smith agreed to everything, albeit reluctantly. There was a place for Joy at Falcroft Sanitarium. An open, first-class ticket would be waiting for her in the name of Alice Jones when she checked in at the Louisville airport. A car and driver would be waiting for her when her flight touched down at White Plains. Now, as Remo drove through the woods in the early morning sunlight, he wondered what he would find in this second visit to Ideal Maternity. He was prepared to bluff or tough it out, whichever method seemed the more appropriate once he was on the scene. A baby-selling racket was despicable, and all the more so if it incorporated homicide to cut its overhead, but Remo still saw no connection with the carbon copy hitmen wearing Thomas Hardy's face and fingerprints. There must be more, a link back to Eugenics Corporation somehow, but each time he thought he had it, the solution skittered out of reach and found a hiding place in his subconscious. Experience told Remo that he would get nowhere agonizing over the elusive problem. Rather, if he put it on a mental shelf and concentrated on the task at hand, he stood a better chance of coming up with something. Finally, the car approached the gravel driveway to Ideal Maternity. The heavy chain was down and puddled in the grass to one side of the driveway, its warning sign forgotten. There was nothing to prevent his driving in. The first thought to cross Remo's mind was that it was a trap, and he considered retreating. He could always park a ways down the road and make his way overland on foot, as he had done the night before. But Remo didn't want to waste the time. He had a sickly feeling in his stomach, formless apprehension mingled with a premonition of disaster, but it did not translate into fear. He thought about the young women who would be the only living witnesses against their captors if the game went sour, wondering exactly how far Dr. Radcliffe and his staff would go to save themselves. He turned into the driveway, checking out the trees on either side. He kept one hand on the door latch and the other on the steering wheel, prepared to bail or ram with equal speed if he was ambushed. Luckily, the short drive up to the building was uneventful. He surveyed the building as he drove up, picking up no signs of movement on the lawn or through the windows. There were no cars in evidence, and Remo saw the back door standing open, just an inch or two, as if the last one out had more important things to think about and didn't care much if the building was secure or not. Remo hoped to prompt any stragglers into revealing themselves, even if through a tiny flicker of movement in an upstairs window. There was nothing. Remo left the car, not bothering to lock it, and walked up to the front door. He tried the knob. Remo lingered on the threshold, sniffing silently at the air for any scent of blood or death. Instead, he picked up Lemon Pledge and Lysol. They were keeping clean, regardless of what transpired inside these walls. He stepped into the foyer, listening for sounds that would suggest a living presence in the house. Immediately on his right was a parlor with chairs and couches arranged around a Sony console television with a VCR on top. The coffee table held a spread of magazines that ran toward 17 and Tiger Beat, in keeping with the average age of inmates at the home. The room was spotless, with nothing to suggest a whirlwind had whipped through hours earlier. He checked the dining room, found nothing, then moved on to the kitchen. Twin refrigerators were well stocked with food, milk, and lean meat, but there would be no breakfast served this morning. Pots, pans, and utensils had been washed up after supper, neatly put away in readiness for morning, but the staff and inmates had evacuated prior to feeding time. From Joy's description of the place, he knew the laundry room would be downstairs, with storage in the basement. He passed the kitchen pantry with its loaded shelves and peeked into the office lately occupied by Matron. his view revealed the first clear evidence of a departure staged in haste. The desk had been swept clean, drawers dumped and scattered. In the corner, two green filing cabinets stood with empty drawers pulled open. There was nothing in the closet but a metal hanger lying on the floor. Whatever paperwork might have once existed, it was gone. A watercolor painting of a meadow bright with poppies hung askew beside the office door, forgotten in the rush to get away. Next, Remo checked the four rooms downstairs, staff quarters by the look of them, and found no clothes, no personal effects of any kind. Each room had beds for two, one pair still neatly made, while the others were in disarray. The maid would not be coming in today. The last room on the ground floor would have been what Joy had called the lab, complete with vinyl floors and cabinets that reminded Remo of a medical examination room. The operating table Joy described was missing, though. Marks on the floor remained where it had been bolted down. The other furnishings were also gone, including overhead track lighting, and someone had cleaned out the cabinets. There was nothing left but a paper towel dispenser on the wall above a stainless steel sink. The kind of heavy-duty gear you found in operating rooms wouldn't fit in a normal car, which meant Bliss and her people had been stepping lively for their getaway. It would have taken at least one truck called in from somewhere, probably with extra muscle to complete the move in record time. Wall sockets, scuff marks, and assorted other signs told Remo that they had also taken out a large refrigerator and some countertop appliances. The air was sharp with disinfectant even now, and while he couldn't prove that Joy's report was accurate in all its particulars, he was prepared to take her word. He left the operating room and went upstairs, still listening for any sound that would betray a lurker in the house. He headed to search the rooms once occupied by the young mothers of Ideal Maternity. There were 10 rooms, which, like the staff quarters, had 2 beds each. 3 of the rooms appeared to have been unoccupied before the hasty exodus, with their beds stripped of linen and closets undisturbed. A 4th room had 1 bed made up for sleeping and the other bare, exactly as Joy Patton had described the room she occupied alone. Remo did the math. There were 12 pregnant girls missing. Their dresser drawers and closets had been emptied out in haste, but no private items were left behind. There was a common bathroom at the far end of the hall, and some of the hanging towels were still damp. Forensics experts could have torn the place apart, coming up with clothing fibers, fingerprints, perhaps hairs clinging to a bar of soap, but there would be no point, at least for Remo. It was no crime to occupy a room or take a shower, and his work was not geared toward a trial, in any case. As for Thomas Allen Hardy and his doppelgangers, Remo knew no more for having toured Ideal Maternity than when he took the case from Smith. He had a sense of precious time escaping, slipping through his fingers. There was one thing he knew for certain. If the place had been evacuated overnight, then Dr. Radcliffe must have been put on alert. Now he would either flee, abandoning his home and clinic in Kentucky, or he would assume that he was safe, his anonymity preserved by the preemptive strike in Dogwood, Indiana. Remo didn't know one way or another, and there was only one way to proceed from here. He had to try and find Radcliffe, face him one-on-one, and wring the secrets of his operation out into the open. He was hoping the doctor would resist and give him a reason to inflict some pain. He turned to leave and came face to face with the ghost, waiting for him 20 feet away at the end of the hall. A semi-automatic pistol was clutched tightly in his hand. Remo recognized the face immediately. He had smashed it several days earlier in Florida. The figure smiled at Remo, raised his pistol in a firm, two-handed grip, and fixed the sights on Remo's chest.
Come here.
Okay, just don't do anything crazy.
Bringing Remo closer was a serious miscalculation, but the stranger had no way of knowing that. He held the pistol steady, keeping both eyes open, just the way they taught at the FBI Academy. At this range, anyone not educated in the fine points of Shinanju would surely have been dead meat, but Remo wasn't worried. As he closed the gap, his adversary started backing toward the stairs, keeping roughly 15 feet between them all the way. He knew exactly where the staircase was, without a backward glance, and he wedged himself into the nearest corner, giving Remo ample room to pass.
Downstairs.
Up close, it was a simple move. Assume you couldn't stop the first shot, dodge the bullet as you closed to striking range, disarm the goon, and finish it at leisure. Remo hesitated long enough to glance downstairs and spotted two more hardy clones. They were even dressed alike, in denim jeans and jackets, though their shirts were different colors, red and green. Both men had pistols aimed at Remo's face. That complicated matters somewhat, but it was only a matter of strategy. If they simply wanted Remo dead, he guessed, all three would probably have come upstairs and opened fire the moment that he showed himself. If they were taking prisoners, it meant whoever sent them must have questions. That, in turn, gave Remo time and space to plan his move. If they were any good at all, they wouldn't try to shoot him on the stairs, where any rounds that missed or passed completely through his body would endanger their teammates. A crossfire in cramped quarters was the worst way to prepare a trap, and they would know that going in. For now, it was best to assume they knew what they were doing and play along.
I'm going. Don't get nervous.
Shut your face and move it.
Yavo, boss.
He started down the stairs, feeling the assassin moving in behind him, hanging back a little so that Remo couldn't turn and grab his weapon. Down below, the other two goons were backing up and separating to triangulate their fire if anything went wrong. From Remo's point of view, it couldn't hurt to shake them up a little. If they got rattled in the process, it could only help his cause.
I don't know what the trouble is, but maybe one of you could introduce me to the man in charge. I've got this cousin with a problem, see,
and shut up!
From what I heard in town, a certain Dr. Radcliffe was a man to see, but I can talk to someone else if he's tied up.
Shut the hell up, I said.
Okay, no problem.
Remo reached the bottom of the staircase and saw the first doppelganger coming down behind him from the corner of his eye. The others held their ground. Remo was boxed in now, but the crossfire problem had not been resolved. He still did not believe they meant to kill him outright while they had a chance to question him. Their sponsor would be desperate for answers by this time, now that everything appeared to be unraveling.
Who sent you here?
Like I said, my cousin—
Cut the shit. We want the truth.
Okay. You got me, pal. She's not my cousin. Are you happy now? I don't know what you people charge to handle the delivery and adoption, but I've got some money put away. You don't need guns, for Christ's sake. It's a business deal.
Who sent you?
The first man stepped closer, his gun almost touching Remo's chest. It was the break he had been waiting for. The timing had to be precise, but Remo had it covered. He reached out with the left hand for his adversary's wrist and clasped it tightly, while his right palm pushed the automatic's muzzle out of line. The gun was a Beretta, double action, with the hammer down, but Remo kept his enemy from firing with a sharp twist of the captive hand and arm. The goon was disarmed before his face could even register surprise, and Remo swung him like a weightless dummy, lifting him completely off his feet and slamming him hard into the ribs of the second assassin. The third man saw it coming and squeezed off two quick shots from his own Beretta in self-defense. The hollow points struck Remo's human shield, mushroomed on impact, and ripped into the man's lungs and liver while his body was still airborne. Remo let him go, watching the surprise and anger fade to nothing as he died in flight. Momentum slammed him into the gunman, and they went down together in a heap, the dead man's weight encumbering his sidekick.
Shit!
The second thug was down on one knee, groping for the pistol he had dropped, about to reach it when a shadow fell across his face, and he glanced up to find death watching him with dark, impassive eyes.
Did Radcliffe send you?
Fuck yourself!
Wrong answer.
Remo kicked the man hard enough to dislocate his left shoulder and flip him over on his back. The fallen pistol was now hopelessly beyond his reach. A backward glance showed the third gunner about to wriggle out from underneath the body of his comrade. He had also lost his weapon, but wasted no time looking for it, rather grabbing for a knife sheathed on his belt. The blade was 6 or 7 inches long and double-edged, black-tinted, with a long groove down the center that allowed a straight-on puncture wound to bleed without obstruction, even if the knife was not withdrawn. It was a killer's weapon, forged for one specific purpose. Unfortunately for him, though, a blade's utility is measured by the man who wields it. This man, under other circumstances, would have been a deadly adversary, but he didn't understand whom he was facing now. Throwing caution to the wind, he came at Remo, leading with the blade. His fate was sealed. Remo sidestepped the thrust, allowed the blade to pass him by, and struck out with a vicious backhand to the assassin's ribs. The man's imploding ribs turned to curved lances that sheared into his lungs, spleen, and diaphragm. A rush of blood as bright as poster paint sprayed from his lips like vomit.
Ugh.
The man collapsed, not dead, but dying, slumped on hands and knees. The knife was forgotten now as he surrendered to the waves of mortal pain. His arms were trembling, barely able to support him. Remo crouched beside him, tangled his fingers in his hair, and gave the head a twist, examining the too familiar face.
Who sent you?
Fuck you!
Remo shoved the body over on its side, its broken neck lolling into a bizarrely unnatural position. The sole survivor of the hit team was watching him and clutching at his injured shoulder, looking for a way out of the trap as Remo turned to face him.
You're a little short of help right now. Why don't you make it easy on yourself?
No thanks.
I don't mind doing it the hard way, but it seems like such a waste.
You don't scare me. I'm not afraid of dying.
Death's no threat. It's the easy way out.
Do what you want. You're dead already. You're just too dumb to know it.
Suit yourself.
He was advancing on the prostrate form when the gunner jackknifed, brought one knee to his chest, and drew a stubby derringer from its concealment in an ankle holster. Remo was prepared to dodge the bullets, knowing that the small gun held only two shots, but he misjudged his captive's plan. Instead of trying for a kill from 6 or 7 paces, the hitman reversed the derringer and shoved it into his own mouth. The power of a bullet fired into the skull at skin-touch range puffed out the dead man's cheeks. His eyes bulged in their sockets, streaked with crimson. The bullet hadn't exited, telling Remo that it must have been another deadly hollow point.
Well, don't that just beat all?
In other circumstances, Remo would have tidied up the battleground, but he would leave it to the cops this time, in case some trace of evidence remained to haunt the owners of Ideal Maternity. He could imagine local uniforms attempting to dissect the Triplet Act and getting nowhere fast, only to be besieged by federal agents once they put it on the wire. He hadn't seen a single phone during his entire search of the building. He would have to find a public box somewhere along the highway on the drive back to the hotel. Looking out the window in the foyer, he saw that his rented Chrysler was the only vehicle in sight. Remo guessed his three late adversaries had either hiked in through the woods or been left behind deliberately to deal with any problems that arose. Remo drove back through the desolate wooded area around Ideal Maternity and entered Elizabeth. He stopped at the first phone booth he came to, outside the local supermarket.
Smitty.
Remo, what have you found?
I checked in at Ideal Maternity again. It was completely stripped. The only thing left behind were three goons.
Hardy's doppelgangers? There are three more?
Well, there were. I took care of them. But everyone else was gone, along with everything. Files, papers, computers, even the examination equipment. What do you advise?
There does not seem to be much choice.
I thought you'd say that. I might as well head on to the next stop in that case. I'll be in touch from Louisville before I make the move. In the meantime, the girl will be arriving at White Plains soon. She's got several names you need to check. Find out if they're available for interviews.
Who am I looking for?
Some former tenants of Ideal Maternity. Word is they were graduated, so to speak. I'd like to know what happened to them. And their children, if it's possible.
All things are possible, if you know where to look and who to ask.
Dr. Quentin Radcliffe took pride in his self-control. No matter what went wrong or how he seethed with anger inwardly, he had the distinct ability to put the best face on the worst of situations, showing subordinates that he was always in control. It was another form of the superiority that set him apart from common men. As the commercials frequently advised, he never let them see him sweat, not even when his life's work had been jeopardized by idiots. He stared across his spacious desk, regarding his unwelcome visitor with thinly veiled contempt. Althea Bliss was silent, knowing anything she volunteered could easily be turned against her. She knew that she had become a liability. Bliss shot a furtive glance at Warren Oxley, seated to the left and slightly behind her, but otherwise she sat and waited for the other shoe to drop. In better times, the former prison guard could be a grim, imposing figure. 5'7" in her stocking feet, she tipped the scales around 190 pounds, some of it muscle. Any softness in her face was strictly flab. Her eyes resembled flakes of granite, set above a nose that always put Radcliffe in mind of dorsal fins. She overcompensated for her thin slash of a mouth by using too much lipstick, but it didn't help. Her knuckles bore the scars of punches thrown in fits of rage. Radcliffe had to swallow back an urge to grab a paperweight and fling it at her pale, round face.
You've disappointed me, Althea.
I understand.
Do you? I wonder.
What I meant to say...
Do you recall what you were doing when I found you?
Yes, sir.
You had about run out of luck, as I remember, at the women's prison down in Talladega. Three distinct and separate charges of brutality before that ugly business with the 18-year-old girl.
Those were lies. No case was ever filed. I'm innocent.
On paper, anyway. Your resignation kept the state from filing charges, I believe.
I'm innocent.
Aren't we all?
It's not my fault. You have to see that.
What I see is that we have lost our primary facility and risked exposure that could cost us everything. Now, if I've missed anything, Althea, please be good enough to fill me in.
I've never lost a girl before.
No, I'll grant you that. You had a perfect record up until last night.
It's not my fault!
Oh, please, please, Althea, don't be tiresome.
But Mahoney and Gutierrez...
are no longer with us, which at least saves me some severance pay. On the other hand, the girl, what was her name again?
Joy Patton, sir.
Whereas the girl has simply vanished, gone. Kaput.
She didn't kill those two gorillas by herself.
Is that supposed to reassure me? Knowing she has allies is supposed to put my mind at ease?
I only
the
meant...
The background check was very thorough. Mr. Oxley.
Surviving family of Joy Patton consists of a stepmother and half-brother out in Bakersfield. The brother started trying to molest her at age 12, apparently succeeding on the day she turned 14. The stepmother took his side when Joy complained. So the girl headed for Los Angeles and hit the streets. If she has any friends worth mentioning, we couldn't find them.
So, who could have followed her halfway across the continent and met her in the middle of the night just when she needed help to get away?
If I knew that, sir, I...
Then you would have had some value, as it is.
You can't blame me for this!
The home was your responsibility. You've let me down, Althea.
No. No, sir.
You censor correspondence, I believe?
Of course. If a girl writes a letter, we get rid of it and tell her it was mailed. No answer comes, she figures it's a brush-off.
Did the Patton girl write any letters?
Not a one.
You're positive?
Yes.
She could have smuggled something out, presumably.
Nobody ever has.
That you know of. I mean, the orderlies were in and out. There were occasional deliveries. Young women can be most persuasive when they're motivated.
No, sir. You can put your mind at ease on that score. Everyone on staff. I had a private chat the day they joined the program. We were crystal clear about the rules and what would happen if they didn't toe the line.
You trusted them?
Let's say I had them covered. On deliveries, we always had them scheduled in advance and kept the girls away from any strangers. There's no way Joy passed any notes to a delivery man. No, sir!
Mm-hmm. Just to recap the event, she slipped out of a room...
The locks were no great shakes. You'll remember we discussed that, and you said it was enough to put the fire alarms on outside doors.
Which brings us to her manner of escaping from the house.
Basement window, like I told you. One way or another, she got through the burglar bars and made her way outside.
Where we assume she met the orderlies?
Mahoney and Gutierrez, right. Joy had the early kitchen shift, like I explained, and when she turned up missing, I sent everybody I could spare to check the grounds. The bodies were 100 yards east of the buildings, give or take. No sign of Joy. That's when I called you to report.
Oxley, do we know how Mahoney and Gutierrez were killed?
No hard specifics, but it looks like they were beaten.
Is there any way to tell?
How many people were involved? We haven't got a clue.
All right.
Radcliffe knew it couldn't have been the police. That much was obvious. The law arrived with badges, warrants, and fanfare. Usually some sound bites on the evening news to top it all off. It was conceivable that one or more policemen might have helped the girl escape in the hopes of making her a witness, but they wouldn't beat two men to death and leave their bodies in the forest. It had to be someone else. The FBI had started asking questions several days ago about eugenics and the Thomas Hardy case. Dr. Radcliffe knew how cheaply false credentials could be had. These days, with the desktop technology available, a high school freshman could present himself as King Farouk, complete with sterling credit references, passport, the works. Someone had also questioned the mortician in Nevada, interrupted Jasper Frayne's assassination down in Florida, and turned up just in time to help one of his subjects vanish from ideal maternity. It added up to major trouble, and the less he knew about his enemy, the more Radcliffe had to worry.
Have the girls begun to settle in?
More or less. There's not much room, you understand.
It's temporary. We should have a larger place available within a day or two.
All right.
I'm sending someone to help you with security. You understand, of course.
Of course.
That's all. Be gone.
Yes, sir.
Dismissed, Althea Bliss rose and headed for the exit. She had a plowman's walk, whatever femininity she once possessed eradicated by her years in uniform. She was a plotter, but efficient in her way, until last night.
Shall I get rid of her?
No, not yet. Let's wait for the final damage estimate.
She could have been involved.
She doesn't have the nerve or the imagination, much less the sympathy. What could a girl like this one offer that would make Althea risk her life?
You never know.
Oxley was thinking of the fourth complaint in Talladega, with its allegations that Althea Bliss had used her office as a prison matron to coerce one of her female charges into sex. Radcliffe assumed the charge was true, and he had warned Bliss on the day of her employment that any misbehavior endangering Project Lazarus would be severely punished. She had known exactly what he meant and didn't argue. For the kind of money Radcliffe paid, she could restrain herself or find some other method to indulge her twisted passion without compromising the project.
She's not that stupid. She'd be cutting off her nose to spite her face.
And what a nose at that.
No time for joking, Oxley. We need to find out who's behind this. Cutting out potential leaks is no damn good if they've already tracked us down.
I'm working on it, Quentin.
So work harder, Warren. And remember what's at stake for all of us.
As if I could forget.
See that you don't. If Lazarus goes down, we go down with it. I mean everybody.
Understood.
In that case, you have work to do.
I'm on my way.
Radcliffe watched Oxley go and wished he felt more confidence in his aide's ability to sort the problem out. A part of him, however, feared things might have gone too far already, that they might have passed the point of no return. The best part of his life had been devoted to the dream he labeled Project Lazarus. Not only had he managed to succeed beyond his wildest dreams, but it had paid off well enough to leave him set for life, whatever happened next. Those who had failed to recognize his genius would eventually see the light. They would come crawling to him on their hands and knees, begging for immortality. The trick in being set for life was managing to stay alive. From this point on, survival had to be Radcliffe's top priority, no matter what the cost. When Remo got back to the motel, Chun was staring out the window watching the passing cars. He wore a bored expression on his parchment face. Remo was amazed that he had taken his eyes away from the TV screen.
Schmidt is waiting for your call.
How long ago did he call?
8 minivans.
Remo walked over to the phone.
What's the word?
I ran the names you gave me with the information from your source. It is not encouraging.
Go on.
Regine Mescal, age 19, from Kansas City, the Missouri side. She has been arrested twice for shoplifting and drug possession. Marijuana, I believe. A chronic runaway dropped out of high school in her sophomore year. There's nothing to suggest how she made contact with ideal maternity, but no one in her family has heard from her in 13 months.
She left the home 9 weeks ago.
Altogether possible, but I cannot trace her. If she has a bank account or driver's license in the States today, she used another name.
What about the others?
For Karen Woodruff, I confirmed her age as 17, born in Muskegon, Michigan. Another dropout. There appears to be a pattern here, but no arrests on record. It has been 11 months since she touched base with any friends or relatives. She has vanished, too.
Are you sure?
As sure as can be. The closest match age-wise turned out to be a black girl in Miami.
2 for 2.
Make that 3 for 3. Sheila Stroud is on the record in Seattle, as reported. Turns 19 next weekend.
If she's still alive.
This one almost graduated, but her parents split in January of her senior year and she unraveled. got in trouble with a boyfriend and dropped out to have the baby, then miscarried. One way or another, she decided no one wanted her around.
What is it with these parents?
I do not know. In any case, she left home about a year ago. The family says she kept in touch the first few weeks, then nothing.
That would be when she hooked up with Radcliffe's people.
Presumably. The Cure mainframes flag 3 Sheila Strouds, but none of them match up. 2 women over 40 and a 6-year-old in Birmingham.
Adoption records?
Nothing. I can tell you Dr. Radcliffe and Ideal Maternity have no official link with any recognized adoption agency in the United States or Canada. Data on the black market is not definitive, of course. It changes every day. And Radcliffe could be operating independently. His clinic there in Brandenburg, for instance, could provide him with a hardcore clientele, and word of mouth would do the rest. For all we know, infant adoptions could be written off as births, with Radcliffe altering the paperwork. I will need his patient files to check that angle out.
Good luck with that.
Precisely.
What about Althea Bliss?
That's actually the one scrap of good news. I found her right away.
What's her deal?
Althea Delaney Bliss was born in 1946 in Dothan, Alabama. Her father was a member of the KKK, but he got drunk one night and set himself on fire while he was lighting up a cross outside a synagogue. He was unemployable from that point on and drank himself to death. He apparently lived long enough to pass his racist attitudes onto his teenage girls. Althea was youngest of the three. She graduated high school with a D average. She spent 1 year in business school, but did not do well. As soon as she turned 21, she found a civil service job as a matron at the Talladega Women's Prison.
Sounds about right.
As you might guess, she had some trouble on the job. There were a number of complaints about excessive force, though none were finally sustained. An 18-year-old inmate charged that Bliss coerced her into unwilling and unnatural relations in the laundry room. That case was pending when she finally decided to quit. She turned in her resignation and disappeared.
And showed up managing Ideal Maternity for Dr. Radcliffe.
Apparently so.
Instead of getting canned and sent to jail, she winds up with her own house full of living dolls.
It is still no proof of murder, but I am inclined to agree with you. I will be watching out for Bliss and company if they resurface in the neighborhood.
12 pregnant girls and all that staff. They can't just disappear.
I am working on tracking them down as we speak. It may take time.
I can't see any way around a face-to-face with Radcliffe.
What is the approach?
I've overdone the bureau angle. Let's try a freelance journalist reporting on advances in fertility research.
Sounds good. At least to get you in with a minimum of fuss.
I can do a little snooping this way.
You are still going with the soft approach?
As far as possible. I don't expect Radcliffe to break down and confess.
Too much to hope for, I suppose. You will keep me posted.
Don't I always, Smitty?
Well, good luck.
Remo glanced over at the master of Shinanju. He was still peering intently out the window, his face a sheet of boredom.
I'm going out again, little father.
Of course. To meet with Smith's amazing doctor who makes dead men walk again.
I'll see if he's home at least.
Does he use sorcery, this man?
I doubt it very much.
Does Smith the insane think so?
No, I think it's scientific, little father.
In another time, before my youth, scientists were the same as sorcerers. They play with nature and attempt to change the way men live.
Is that so bad?
It depends on the method and the goal. Why should an old man in a coma be connected to machines that do what his own flesh cannot? Is he so great that we must keep him with us always? Or are men so afraid of what may follow death that they delay its call, regardless of the cost?
This life is all we have.
Then, by all means, live it. If you spend all your days evading death, where is the time for life?
What is this, today's freaking inspirational sermon?
I am bored. You continually stuff me away in hotel rooms like some deranged spinster aunt. I must do something to while away the time. Are you going to kill Smith's doctor?
Most probably.
It is for the best. We can end this wild duck chase and go home.
Right now, Radcliffe's punishment came second to finding the man in the first place. It also wouldn't reveal the mystery behind the Hardys' deadly doppelgangers, who seemed to be multiplying by the day. Remo had to know what he was up against before he could destroy anything. Remo followed Highway 60 south from Louisville to Muldra, several miles above the Fort Knox gold depository, where he branched off to the west toward Brandenburg. Of course, there was a chance he might not get to see the doctor at all. Radcliffe could be in hiding, or he might refuse to meet with Remo. Stranger things had happened to reporters, but whichever way it went, he would be able to examine at least part of Radcliffe's clinic. Whatever happened in the next few hours, he would get a feeling for the man. The Family Service Clinic had a wholesome ring to it. A passing motorist would have to stop and read the fine print on a sign no more than 3 feet square to realize the clinic dealt exclusively with family planning and fertility. The structure proper was quaint, concealed by ivy-covered walls and weeping willows, but the wrought iron gate was open, waiting for him. Remo took the bait and drove inside. Ideal Maternity had been an older building, modernized and renovated, while the clinic was a relatively new addition to the landscape, cunningly designed to look antique, at least from the outside. There was a blacktop parking lot on the west side, with spaces for a dozen cars marked off in yellow paint. The spacious lawn was neatly trimmed and bordered, with a flagstone path that led him from the parking lot to the front door. Inside, a blonde receptionist who could have modeled swimsuits for a living greeted Remo with a dazzling smile.
How may I help you, sir?
I'm hoping for a chance to speak with Dr. Radcliffe.
Oh, is he expecting you?
Unfortunately, no, but I was in the neighborhood and thought I'd take a chance.
And you are?
Remo Washington, reporter. I'm with News Time, working on a feature piece for next week's issue. Infertility, its causes, new treatments, that type of thing.
I'll have to see if doctor is available. We normally require appointments.
Understood. I appreciate your help.
No promises.
Remo wandered over to the nearest picture window as the receptionist stood and stepped through an open doorway to the back. Outside, the grounds resembled snapshots of a well-kept park, except they were deserted. Where a park would have had children running, shouting, lovers strolling hand in hand, the clinic grounds had been monopolized by two fat squirrels who chased each other up and down the trunks of old established trees. The whole place had a sterile feel about it, as if Radcliffe had constructed his ideal oasis underneath a dome that let the sunlight in but kept the world at bay. Long moments passed before a sleek brunette entered through the same door the receptionist had exited from. She was tall, 5'8 or so, with thick, dark hair that framed an oval face, full lips, a perfect nose, green eyes that could be warm, he guessed, when they were not on full alert. A stylish, three-piece suit could not disguise the luscious body underneath. Even without a smile, she bumped the blonde receptionist back to the second string.
Good morning. Mr. Washington, is it?
Remo Washington. I write for...
News Time. So I understand. You asked to see my father?
I'm hoping for a word with Dr. Radcliffe.
I'm Chelsea Radcliffe. We weren't expecting you.
And I apologize for that. The truth is, I spent the last 2 days in Indianapolis with Dr. Kirk and Dr. Russell. They suggested that a visit to your father's clinic might add something to my story.
Really? Kirk and Russell?
As I live and breathe.
You could have called ahead.
They didn't bring it up until last night. Anyway, you know the freelance writer's rule of thumb. It's easier to get forgiveness than permission. Yeah. After all, what if I had called ahead and Dr. Radcliffe still refused to see me?
Mr. Washington.
Please, call me Remo.
Mr. Washington, my father is a very busy man.
I understand, of course.
You do? And yet you never heard of him before last night.
By reputation, certainly, but I had no idea where he was working.
We do not invite publicity.
What could it hurt?
Mr. Washington, my father's work is not confined to pure research. His patients have included many wealthy, influential families. They aren't celebrities, of course, and we intend to keep it that way. Infertility is still considered an embarrassment in certain quarters. Confidentiality is critical, not only from a legal aspect, but in terms of simple trust.
I understand. If your father would agree to speak with me in general terms about his research, some of the advances he's made, I'm sure it would be good for business.
We're less concerned with profit here than service to our clients, Mr. Washington. I don't believe that...
No insult was intended, Miss Radcliffe.
That's Dr. Radcliffe, Mr. Washington, Ph.D.
What field, if I may ask?
Psychology.
I bet that comes in handy with the cases you get here.
I really don't have the time.
How's this for an idea? Why don't you ask your father if he wants to talk to me? If he says no, I'm out of here, and no hard feelings. On the other hand...
I screen the visitors who show up unannounced.
And I'm sure you do a bang-up job. But I have a hunch your father can decide this kind of question for himself.
Wait here, please.
Remo tracked her with his eyes, appreciating the unconscious sway of Chelsea Radcliffe's walk. Chelsea Radcliffe was back within 5 minutes with the same determined stride, but with a new expression on her face. It fell short of concern, but there was something else that had not been present in their first encounter moments earlier. Confusion.
My father has agreed to see you. I'll show you the way.
With pleasure. It's quite a layout you have here.
All the latest methods with a touch of down-home comfort.
Chelsea led him past a dozen doors before they reached the last one on the left. Its simple label, private, could have served a broom closet just as well as Dr. Radcliffe's inner sanctum.
Come.
The single syllable told Remo much about the man before he crossed the threshold and beheld his quarry in the flesh. Whatever else he was, whatever he aspired to, Quentin Radcliffe had an ego on him that demanded deference, a visible distinction from his various subordinates. And those subordinates apparently included daughter Chelsea, in the public eye, if nowhere else. She led the way into a stylish office, furnished with a desk, settee, and heavy chairs that may have been antiques or just expensive knockoffs. Remo couldn't tell, nor did he care. The man who came around the desk to meet him was a stocky 5'7", shorter than his daughter, but his attitude made up the difference. Quentin Radcliffe had a shock of snow-white hair receding slightly in the front, which combed back stiffly from his squarish face. His nose was thick and broad, above a narrow mouth, but Remo focused on his eyes. They looked like amethysts, just short of violet, shaded by his spiky, bristling brows. The tan was probably a sun lamp special, since it did not seem to reach his large, blunt-fingered hands.
Good morning, Mr. Washington.
Remo could tell that the display of ignorance was part of Radcliffe's act. He would have heard the name from Chelsea moments earlier, but he appeared far too busy and important to remember it for any length of time.
From Newsweek, I believe you said.
News Time.
Is that the tabloid?
Well, no matter. Please, sit down.
Radcliffe gestured toward one of the vacant chairs, and Remo sat, a bit surprised when Chelsea settled in another to his left.
So, Mr. Washington, what brings you all the way to Brandenburg?
As I told your daughter, sir, I'm working on a piece for next week's issue that'll deal with human infertility from several angles. Common causes of the problem and the latest medical solutions, psychological effects of infertility on married couples in today's society, the whole nine yards.
If you'll forgive the observation, Mr. Washington, your premise won't exactly break new ground.
No, sir, that's true. Some topics never lose their impact, though, and that includes most subjects where the family and children are involved. Times change, as do the expectations and reactions of a childless couple. As for medical advances, well, 6 months can mean a whole new ball game, so to speak.
And which concerns you more, the human side or science?
I would hope to find the two are integrated, Doctor.
Well, of course. You spoke to Dr. Kirk and Dr. Russell, I believe?
That's right.
I'm surprised they mentioned me at all, much less recommended that you speak to me in person.
Well, it wasn't so much a suggestion, Doctor, as a... how should I put it? No offense intended. But Russell seemed to take it as a joke.
I see. Well, of course, they would attempt to mock my work.
May I be frank, sir?
Oh, please do.
I wasn't that impressed with Doctors Kirk and Russell, if you follow me. I mean, I read up on the subject pretty well before I started doing interviews, and much of what they've done struck me as being, well...
derivative? Perhaps a trifle unoriginal?
Exactly. When they mentioned you in passing, such a denigrating tone, I wondered if there could be something in the way of jealousy behind it. Medical research is so competitive, I thought perhaps...
You're quite perceptive, Mr. Washington.
I've done my homework, too, even though I didn't have much time. Thank God the morgue was open.
Pardon me?
Oh, the reference library at News Time. Sorry, once you're used to newsroom slang.
Homework, you said?
On you. The background stuff. I hate cold interviews. They're always coming out sounding lifeless, and we waste time going over things I should already know. Of course, I only had time for the basics.
The basics.
Right. Your schooling, the internship and residency, all the years you spent as head of research for Eugenics Corporation.
Radcliffe blinked at that. It only took a fraction of a second, but Remo seemed to watch it in slow motion, like the action of a camera's lens preserved on time-lapse film. He had a sense that Dr. Radcliffe would preserve that moment when he spoke the unexpected name and take it out for later study when he was alone.
Eugenics.
Right, in Belding, Michigan.
Yes, 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 of course. It takes me back to here, sir.
And you recall the CEO?
Excuse me?
Jasper Frayne.
Old Jasper, certainly. I haven't talked to him in years.
You missed your chance. Someone killed him at his home in Florida a few days ago.
Radcliffe went through the motions of appearing shocked, but Remo focused more on Chelsea, judging her reaction as the real McCoy. She frowned. It could have been surprise, or something else.
Oh my, there's so much crime in Florida these days. When I finally retire, I plan on Arizona. I have the land already, near Lake Havasu.
You'll miss him then?
To be honest, not really. We were colleagues, but I never thought of us as friends. Frayne handled cash, you understand, which does make the real work possible. He certainly wasn't a scientist, though.
I understand. You spent so much time on genetic research, Doctor, that I can't help thinking there must be some intimate connection with your present work. Has anything from the eugenics period been useful in your treatment of infertile couples?
Well, of course we draw on what we know. That's only natural. Infertility per se is often the result of injury or illness, possibly a birth defect or some environmental factor. If a specific difficulty is remedial, then we intervene with the most efficacious, non-invasive means available. If we can modify behavior to achieve results, so much the better. Drugs would be the next line of attack, with surgery reserved for special cases.
That includes genetic surgery?
Oh, you're discussing theory now. Such work has been successful on the lower animals under controlled conditions, but we have not yet achieved the skill required to work such magic on our own.
You've thought about it, though.
What scientist has not? I assure you, Mr. Washington, that childless couples are as much concerned about the quality of offspring they produce, more so, I imagine, than about the simple act of giving birth. If we had choices, who would not prefer to sire a Beethoven, an Einstein, even a McCartney, than a simple drone who trudges through his life and never truly rises to a challenge? Wouldn't you prefer a child to make you proud who leaves his mark behind?
I never really thought about it. I take it, then, that you don't carry on genetic research at the clinic?
The specifics of my work are not for publication yet. As you pointed out, the field is quite competitive, and some of my esteemed colleagues unfortunately have a minimal concern with ethics.
But it's safe to say that any research you have done, or may be doing, is distinct and separate from the treatment of your patients here.
Indeed. You know as well as I do, Mr. Washington, that most testing on human subjects is confined to government facilities or major universities where bureaucrats can practice oversight.
I wonder if there's time for me to take a look around the clinic. I'd like to get some pictures.
No, that's impossible.
Perhaps a walk through the place, then, to give my readers some idea of what the cutting edge feels like.
A walkthrough should be harmless, I suppose. Sadly, I don't have the time right now, but I believe my daughter...
Yes, of course.
Well, there you are.
The doctor rose, came back around his desk, and squeezed Remo's hand in lieu of shaking it.
I'm glad we had this little talk, and I look forward to your article.
I'll have a copy faxed out in advance, just to make sure you're quoted accurately, and I have my facts straight.
Fair enough. Good day.
Remo and Chelsea Radcliffe stood and headed back into the corridor.
We'll have to make this quick. I do have work.
Of course. Lead on.
Here are the examination rooms.
Remo and Chelsea passed by the numbered doors that stood between her father's office and the foyer. Choosing one at random, Chelsea led the way inside. It was, indeed, a standard treatment room, complete with padded table, chairs, a stool on casters, sink and paper towel dispenser, metal cabinets on the walls, assorted medical equipment on the counters.
No one stays the night, then?
On rare occasions, when there's minor surgery involved, or a reaction to some medication... But we always try to send them home as soon as possible.
And treatment normally includes a course of counseling.
Where indicated. Some couples don't require it. Others are distraught and desperate by the time they come to see us. Since emotions may influence both fertility and fetal growth, we treat all aspects of the problem. Moving on.
Their next stop was an ultra-modern lab where sperm and eggs were frozen, thawed, and merged in vitro, in the cases where traditional attempts had met with failure. Remo listened, making a show out of taking notes. He couldn't help but feel disappointment. None of this was giving him any of the answers he needed. Attached to the laboratory was an operating room with all the fixings, plus a spacious lounge of sorts where Chelsea said she met with clients who required her services.
You must be running short of time right now.
That's right.
But I would love to hear some more about your end.
My end?
Of what goes on here.
I don't see what...
Unfortunately, Dr. Radcliffe, I'm on deadline, and my editor, well, let's just say he makes Saddam Hussein look like a pussycat.
Then maybe you ought to find another job.
I've considered it, but I can't shake the curiosity.
That killed the cat, you know.
I've had my shots.
Well, in any case...
Hey, I was thinking, if you're free tonight...
Tonight?
If I could buy you dinner, talk some more about your work. No names, of course. I understand the ethics problem. But we don't hear much about the mental and emotional impact of infertility.
Where are you staying?
Well, nowhere yet. I drove from Louisville.
You've got a fair wait until supper time.
I'll manage.
7:30, then. You passed Antonio's as you were coming into town?
Italian place, out on the highway.
Right. I'll meet you.
I could pick you up.
I doubt that very much.
Chelsea Radcliffe turned away and left Remo staring after her. At any other time, her hard-to-get act might be amusing, but there was too much work left to be done, and it was deadly serious. The Radcliffes needed more investigation before he could decide on what to do. But he was getting closer. He could feel it.